A whole lot of not much going on in housing prices.
And Dewey, Liquidate & Howe, one of the country's biggest law firms, goes belly up. From APM, American Public Media in New York, hello, I'm David Brancaccio.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, May 29th.
Coming up, Australia tries to lure investors down under.
And the only good law degree may just be a patent law degree.
You'll hear all about it on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Housing prices in March were up a tiny bit from the month before. That's according to the Case-Shiller Price Index. They're basically still stuck at their lowest level since the housing crisis began. Here to help us make sense of all of this is Julie Niemann with Smith, Moore & Company in St. Louis. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Stacey.
So, Julie, home prices basically flat in March. What's your take on this news?
Oh, this is high excitement. They're just not plunging
really
anymore. We've got the hemorrhaging has stopped and the bottoming process has begun. There's no miraculous resurrection in sight, that's for sure. That would take a booming economy, and we don't have that. But sideways is a good thing. Now, everything is by location, so there's improvement in some regions that offset the decline in others. In fact, some of the declining regions are still probably going to go down another 5%, but the rest is stabilizing, and that's great news.
Well, Julie, if we have hit bottom and prices are going to start to rise from here, what does that mean for the economy?
Well, for the banks especially, the banks are sitting on a pile of money to lend. We've got record low rates, but they're not lending because you don't like to loan money on an asset that's still going down in prices. But the prices are at the levels of 10 years ago. This is a huge positive.
Wow. Well, the other big drag on the economy right now, other than housing, has been unemployment. Is that potentially turning around, too?
Well, that is a wild card. It's picking up in the private sector. Corporations are sitting on a pile of cash, though, and recently their CEOs announced that they would not be buying back more of their own stock. They're going to be spending it on plant and equipment, and that trickles down to unemployment. You're going to see rises in unemployment over the summer. This is a real positive. Consumer sentiment, which is really cautious at now, I think it's going to start picking up.
Julie Niemann with Smith, Moore & Company in St. Louis. Thank you, Julie.
You bet.
In what's seen as the biggest collapse of a corporate law firm, Dewey & LaBeouf filed for bankruptcy protection last night. Financial mistakes, heavy debt, and the defection of top talent get the blame, and there are reports the firm won't reorganize, it'll liquidate. Marketplace's Amy Scott has been looking into the story. Hello, Amy.
Hello.
What else went wrong at that firm?
Well, one thing is that they got too big just when the economy turned. And one way they did that was by luring talent away from other law firms by offering guaranteed compensation regardless of how well the firm did. So when revenue started falling off, Dewey was still on the hook for millions of dollars in this guaranteed pay. I spoke earlier with a consultant, Kent Zimmerman, who helps law firms with their growth plans. And he says the trouble at Dewey was a lot of the partners didn't know about these deals.
And I think after Dewey, many lawyers will be much more involved in wanting to have a say and be on board and build consensus around their firm's growth plan.
And in fact, as you mentioned, you know, most of Dewey's 300 partners had been leaving in droves because of concerns about these deals and the firm's financial position.
What do you think, Amy? We're going to see more of this, of these collapses in the legal profession?
Well, the economy certainly hasn't been kind to law firms. Zimmerman says these sorts of guaranteed pay deals are highly unusual. But other people say there is a problem with the culture of these big law firms. You know, there's too much emphasis on growth. They're not so much partnerships in the traditional sense anymore. There have been several bankruptcies, though this is the biggest. And analysts say there likely will be more.
Marketplace's Amy Scott, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
It is a tough job market right now for most lawyers and paralegals, unless you happen to specialize in patent law, as Marketplace's Quina Kim reports.
Lots of lawyers can't get jobs, but for patent attorneys, it's a seller's market. Julie Locke is a headhunter at Lateral Link.
Every time I get a firm calling us saying, we need these people, the first question I ask is, what makes you different than any other law firm?
Locke says she has more than 20 firms looking for patent lawyers. Last year, it was half that. And it's not just for tech. Pharmaceutical and biotech companies want them too. Michael Rustad is a professor at Suffolk University Law School. He's seen a big uptick in companies paying for engineers and scientists to become patent lawyers.
Their entire law school tuition is paid, books, salary.
Rustad says that's a big shift from the past.
Some of the larger firms didn't start intellectual property programs. Partly the image was that these scientific and technological types wouldn't get along with the corporate clients.
Now it's those corporate types who have to get along. Revenge of the nerds? In San Francisco, I'm Queen Akim from Marketplace.
A new poll shows more Greek voters support politicians who favor the European Union bailout of Greece. Elections in Greece earlier this month rattled the markets when voters favored political groups that opposed the EU bailout and the austerity measures that came with it. Our own Stephen Beard is in Athens. He joins us now. Stephen, what is the mood like in the Greek capital right now?
Well, it's about 3 months since I was here last, and I can tell you today in this city, standing here on the streets of Athens, I can see the deterioration in that time. This is a city obviously on the slide. It's a lot grubbier than it was. There's a lot more graffiti, a lot more begging as well. The mood is depressed.
Now, Stephen, in the last election, Greek voters were favoring some politicians who rejected the austerity measures that came along with the bailout that Greece received from the European Union. Does it look like the Greeks will vote the same way in the future?
The latest opinion polls suggest that one of the mainstream parties that negotiated the bailout is edging ahead. And if those polls are correct, this could mean that after the next election, we could see a government here in Athens that won't seek a confrontation with the IMF and the Eurozone's and Greece's European partners. It won't reject the bailout terms out of hand. But, you know, even the mainstream parties here now say that the bailout terms have to be renegotiated, they have to be softened, something which the German government has refused to consider. It said to Greece, if you don't deliver on your commitments to cut your budget and to reform, you won't get any more money.
Are there worries that Greece will get kicked out of the Eurozone in Greece?
Well, many Greeks say the Germans are bluffing, that they wouldn't dare to let Greece fall out of the Eurozone because the whole thing then might unravel. But I think the Greeks are worried, certainly the ones I've spoken to. They are very anxious about being pushed out of the euro. They fear the inflationary chaos that might follow. But equally, they can't stand any more austerity. And they say austerity isn't working. People are suffering. Unemployment for the young has hit 50%. So the Greeks really are between a rock and a hard place.
Our own Stephen Beard on the streets of Athens. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Stacey.
It's primary day in Texas. The presidential race is not much of a cliffhanger there, but teachers will be watching a few key votes to gauge the state's support for schools and students. Last year, the Texas legislature cut more than $5 billion from education. That upset many Texas parents, and now education is a big campaign issue, as Marketplace's David Gura reports.
The number of students enrolled in Texas schools has gone up every year by about 80,000. Sherry Greenberg teaches public policy at the University of Texas.
For the first time, there was a decision made for public education to, in fact, not fund that growth.
Usually in polls, only a small percentage of Texans have said education is the issue they care about the most. James Henson runs the Texas Politics Project.
People that pay attention to education are always waiting for it to sort of be something that moves the needle in a big way.
That may have happened with last year's cuts. Carolyn Boyle runs the Texas Parent PAC. That's a group that endorses candidates, both Democrats and Republicans, who make education a priority.
There's many people who said enough is enough. We need people coming to the Capitol in Austin who know about schools, who care about schools, and have courage.
Boyle says more than 20 candidates are running on their experience in education. And like Boyle, they're worried about teachers getting laid off and classes getting too big. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
So, David, were you a good student in school?
More or less, most of the time.
Did you ever have trouble paying attention?
Sometime, yeah, of course.
Well, there's an invention for you. Scientists at the University of Wisconsin have developed a robot teacher, and it can tell when students' minds start to wander.
Yeah, well, when their foreheads hit the table?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. The robot speaks and delivers lessons, and all the while it's monitoring students' minds with electrodes. And if the robot senses attention starting to wane, it responds by raising its voice or gesturing. And in tests, the robot was able to boost learning retention.
That's interesting. Couldn't it have just, like, activated the electrodes to wake him up?
Right. I don't know if it had anything to do with the laser gun pointed at their heads, but who knows?
Oh, yeah. Well, the robot teacher at work.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
China and Japan will increasingly trade each other's currencies directly without using the U.S. dollar to set the exchange rate. The change, starting this Friday, is a new step toward a world where the U.S. dollar is not the last word in global currencies, a bit like buying a house without a realtor or a stock without a broker. Joining us for more context is the BBC's Roland Burke in Tokyo. Good morning, Roland.
Good morning.
So how much trading is there between Japan and China via the U.S. dollar?
Well, a very large amount. China has overtaken the United States to be Japan's biggest trading partner, and trade has increased exponentially over the last 10 years. So what's happening now is that the two countries have agreed that from June the 1st, there can be direct trading between the yen and the yuan. The idea is to cut out the middleman.
The middleman being the U.S. dollar, indeed. What implication does this have for the dollar as what's called a reserve currency, the be-all and end-all currency around the world?
In terms of the dollar, it means that increasingly the dollar will be used less in Asia. But perhaps one good side from the point of view of the United States of this is that as the yuan becomes more convertible, its value should increase. That's what the United States has been pushing for, because it says that the weakness of the yuan has given China an unfair advantage up to now.
Because the stronger the Chinese currency, the more competitive, for instance, U.S. goods might be if sold in China.
That's the complaint of the United States and other Western countries as well, that with the currency being artificially held low, it means that Chinese goods are much cheaper than they should be when they're sold in the United States. It means that Chinese labor is cheaper, so it's easier for firms and workers in China to compete against American firms and workers. So this is a step towards perhaps that situation easing a bit for the United States.
Roland Burke, BBC in Tokyo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you have $5 million lying around and you like wide open spaces and crocodiles, you could find a new home down under. Australia has just announced a new class of visa intended to attract investor types to the country. But as Stuart Cohen reports, they're not expecting a lot of Americans to take the bait.
Australia is rolling out the red carpet for millionaires. Starting July 1st, they're offering permanent residency to anyone willing to invest $5 million in an Australian company, a venture capital fund, or government bonds. Immigration Minister Chris Bowen says Australia wants to attract the kind of people able to keep the country's economy competitive.
So I think what we're looking for is an investment in Australia financially, also an investment emotionally, because these are people who can contribute a lot to investing in our capital and providing for investment in very important projects throughout the country. I think there'll be strong interest in this.
But the government isn't looking to the West to import its millionaires. Instead, Australia expects most of the interest to come from countries in the East, particularly China, where the super rich might want a better place to live.
The private wealth market of China is ever increasing. Australia is well placed to attract investors who are looking for the financial security offered by a stable government and economy.
But critics complain the new program prioritizes the wealthy over refugees and others waiting to be reunited with their families. In Sydney, I'm Stuart Cohen for Marketplace.
New research from the Brookings Institution says Americans will pay up to $1,500 more in rent every month to live in a walkable neighborhood. That's near their dry cleaners or grocery store or favorite restaurant.
Christopher Leinberger of the Brookings Institution was the lead researcher on the study, and he joins us now to talk about his findings. Good morning, Mr. Leinberger.
Good morning.
So I thought Americans are into the suburban cul-de-sac, usually requiring a fossil fuel-powered vehicle to get there after a long commute. You're finding that Americans actually have different preferences.
That was then, this is now. And there's been a structural shift in what many households, not all households, but what many households want as far as their piece of the American dream. And it involves a walkable urban place where you can get most of your daily needs met by foot, by bicycle, by rail transit, And obviously the car plays a role here as well, but it's just not the one and only way you must get around, which is the case for most American households today.
Is this a new phenomenon?
It started somewhere in the mid-90s. We began to see elements of it with our downtown turnarounds taking place throughout the country. But it's really begun to take off now, not just in our center cities, but this is more a trend of urbanizing the suburbs. And so we see a lot of indicators that it's happening. But the most important indicator is that people are willing to pay a lot more per square foot for walkable urban places than for comparable drivable suburban places.
So that's very interesting. You're not necessarily just talking about the old urban cores. It might be out in a suburb, but the idea is if you have a house in the suburb, wouldn't it be nice not to have to get into the car if you have to get some milk or you want to go to an art gallery or something?
Exactly. That it really is about convenience, and this is about providing choice. It's not as if the car is going away. It's just that you want to be able to walk certain places. You want to be able to take transit certain places, and you don't want to mow 2 acres of lawn.
Well, Christopher, I mean, this is very true for David and I. We're in New York, and there's a lot of walkability here. But is this true in smaller cities as well?
We're seeing this throughout the country. And while there's certainly some metro areas such as Washington and New York and Portland, Oregon, and Seattle and Denver that are in front of this trend, you're also seeing it in small towns like Chattanooga and Columbus, where I can demonstrate that walkable urban places on a price per square foot basis are selling and renting for more than drivable suburban places on a price per square foot basis, and that the lines have crossed over the last decade. And really the Great Recession, the collapse of the mortgage market, really added, it really sped up this process.
It seems to me the traffic is the friend of this process. If you spend enough time stuck in traffic, not really getting anywhere, you're going to start to rethink how you want to live.
There's a great billboard as you're entering the freeway, leaving downtown Boston for a rental apartment project there that says that if you lived here, you'd be home by now. So, yes, traffic congestion certainly is a part of this. I don't think it's just the traffic congestion. There's a whole host of factors, one of which is demographic, that 75% of households in this country right now are singles and couples, which is the target market for walkable urban. And over the next 20 years, we're going to be adding a lot of households to this country, and 85% of the new growth in households in this country will be singles and couples.
Christopher Leinberger of the Brookings Institution. Thank you so much, Christopher.
Thank you.
With the payoff being a fine burrito with fresh cilantro or golden falafel in a pita, who among us has not stood in line waiting to get lunch from a truck? Some are gourmet, some are just scary, but among the attractions of a food truck, they tend to be independent. But as Susan Vallett reports, a chain restaurant is getting into the game.
A half dozen food trucks fill a parking lot south of Los Angeles. There's a Filipino taco truck, a heavy metal-themed gourmet burger truck, and then there's the Double Z truck, where workers stand outside taking orders.
One French dip slider?
No, make it two.
Two with fries or without?
What makes the Double Z truck special is that it's owned by Sizzler. Yes, that Sizzler, the long-established but recently declining restaurant chain.
We've been at so many events where people turn around and be like, are you kidding me? This is Sizzler?
That's Double Z truck chef Chris Rader. He says the menu at a Sizzler restaurant is completely different than you'd find on the truck.
It's a way for us to help rebuild. We're trying to use this as a vehicle to propel it up as a marketing scheme, as getting out with the people and things like that. So it kind of revitalizes the youth of Sizzler, so it's not just going after one crowd.
Meaning the senior crowd the chain's become known for. And Rader says Sizzler's truck, which hit L.A.'s roads in August, stays in neighborhoods where Sizzler restaurants are. He thinks just because corporations are getting into the food truck biz, they won't put the little guys out of business.
Just like brick-and-mortar restaurants, there's always going to be great mom-and-pop restaurants, and then there's going to be these corporate, you know, Applebee's and everything else that's going to be out there. So I don't think that it'll do anything as changing the landscape of having somebody, of creating grilled cheese truck.
But expect most of the big restaurant chains to start rolling out trucks soon. That's according to John Self. He's a restaurant expert at the University of Cal Poly Pomona.
And the winner is going to be the public
And I think the winner will be the restaurant industry, because it'll expand into a totally different new market.
Independent food trucks say they welcome the competition from big corporations, but they worry that too many trucks from the chain restaurants could flood the market and sour it for everyone. In Los Angeles, I'm Susan Vallett for Marketplace.
And finally, it's a mobile phone. It's a Geiger counter. There's news this morning that a mobile phone company called SoftBank is coming out with a smartphone in Japan this summer that will monitor radiation levels in this post-Fukushima world. The Pantone line of handsets will come with a Geiger counter microchip built in. The phone can also save the location of the radiation readings and will be available, helpfully, in 8 cheery colors. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
On APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.